C1A. Number 18A.
Now, I just wonder how many I shall be able to put to sleep this afternoon. And then afterwards, I wonder how many I can wake up. The point is that we come to the last subject of love, and in this last subject, we get the subjective view of what the chapter has taught us up to now. The spiritual line of unfoldment shows that through the first five tones or subjects, we got a sense that reaching out for the unity with God, that asks of us the laying down of the fault of a false unit. In the first five subjects, the demands were to give up the wrong. And there was always a command and demand of a Eucharist which asked us to lay down a false sense. Then, having done that, and that is really the climax of the scriptural note, the climax of the scriptural note is climaxing to soul, principle to life. And then, having seen that point, having laid down the mortal sense of mind, spirit, soul, and principle and life, then we have seen that the true sense of man is being born to us. That then we have put all obstructions out of the way so that the birth of true manhood can take place. And so we witness in the sixth subject what this atonement does, namely it shows we are one man, God with us. And now, having seen what this one God brings into being, the moment we have accepted that God, that life is God, that the Father is God, that the only Creator is God, having accepted that, truth has shown what this creation is, which flows from God, and so has given us that sense of the Son of God. And now, we come to the seventh, and here we find now that sense of the motherhood of God, which stands behind the whole chapter of atonement and saying, well, what is it that is working behind that whole plan of atonement? What is it that demands that we atone our mind with the divine mind? What is it that demands that we turn away from the material concept of life to the imperishable things of spirit? What is it that wants us to make so strong and perseverant that we are not going back from our way, from sense to soul? What is it that jolly well demands of us that we atone with a scientific sense and not with a theological, humanly doctrinal sense of atonement? What is it really that says to us, lay down that false sense of life, that worldly sense of life. Go and atone yourself with the true sense of life. What is it that asks that to do? Is that a doc? Is that, what is it? And so the last subject often says, that which enforces that atonement is the fact that God is love. What does it mean? God is love are just three words. Three words symbolizing what? Symbolizing something which is divinely factual, namely which says there is in the divine universe, in the universe of reality, exists a fact which says that the principle never loses sight of its idea. That's love. That's what we symbolize with the term love, capital L. The fact in the universe, in the divine reality, there is a fact in divine reality, no matter if we like it or don't like it, no matter if we know it or don't know it, there is a working fact in reality which always keeps us and establishes and holds fast to the unity of principle and idea, and always brings, therefore, drives, therefore, every idea back to its principle. That's love. That's the term love. that wonderful sense that in reality God and man are never separate, that there is an intimate, lovely unity between God and man. And not only that there is a unity, but that this unity has a Christ, and therefore that this unity always does everything possible, everything within the whole range of possibilities, within the whole range of infinite possibilities, to keep and hold every idea at the bosom of God. And therefore, humanly seen, translated to the human, presents itself always as that wonderful fact that every idea is always drawn back to God. And therefore, there is in the universe that fact, that existing fact, no matter if we like it or don't like it, no matter if we resist it or accept it, no matter if we understand it or don't understand it, but the fact exists and is at work, and that fact says always, I draw always every right idea back to the bosom of God, back to the fulfillment of that idea. Therefore, love always says, I mind, and therefore I draw all right motives and all divine mindedness back to the divine mind. Therefore, I draw all activity back to the one spiritual reflection. That fact of love as spirit always says, because I can't be separate from reflection, I am at work in that way that every idea in the universe can't help reflecting the whole of God. And so love says, I'm soul, and because love says, I'm never separate from my idea, therefore never separate from the idea of soul, it shows that love does everything and works in that way to bring back our true spiritual selfhood to the bosom of God. And so in principle, because love is principle, and love is never separate from its idea, and always beholds its own idea, it says as principle, therefore, I draw every working activity, every demonstrative activity back to the glorification of love. I bring all the activities of every idea into line to fulfill the purpose of love, and no other purpose. And so as life, because love is also life and love is never separate from its own idea, love always draws all sense of life to the one life, to the only life, and therefore is irresistible in that attractive activity, and therefore shows that nothing can prevent life to be life, and then as truth and love. But today I just want to go as far as love as life. That's in a few words what Atonement and Eucharist is going to tell us. See, we find perhaps the key, the best, if we see that tone of love which says God is that forcible power and that forcible law behind atoning, behind atonement. Behind that which has that impulsion which brings about atonement. So whereas in the first five or six subjects we had more an objective view of atonement, just clarifying what atonement meant and what it involved to us, now we get the subjective view. In love we get the subjective view. And so more or less recapitulate the first six subjects again, but viewed from a subjective point of view. Viewed from the point of view of love, which says, after all, behind the whole chapter is something at work which is divine and not human. It's the divine plan at work. What is the divine plan in Atonement and Eucharist? The divine plan of love here is to draw every idea back to God. Therefore, love will not rest, will give no rest to the human mind, to mortal mind, to the egoistic mind, until it capitulates and accepts the atonement with the one mind and accepts the heavenly mindedness. Can you see that? That's what the first tone will imply. It's a very logical sequence and something which we can deduce quite easily. Now, in order to go, this seventh subject is very, very involved. It's first of all, it's goes over about 20 pages, so it's very long. And its structure is so detailed and so exact and so to the point, but so involved, that I felt that I would give you, for an exception, no questions to look up, but to give my, as a help for your study, my own little findings and jotting down, just to make it a bit easier for you and especially for this afternoon to follow what we are doing. So if you take this the questionnaire under the seventh subject and just have it a bit before your eyes as I go on, it may help you to see where I am and so not to get too much mixed up with what I say. Now, let's take, see, first I try to epitomize the main tone. Do you see that? Main tone epitome on page 13, which I rendered here. You will find your own rendering and your own verse, and you should find it, think it over, and I'm sure if I think it over half a year from hence, I may put it in a little bit in this, in other words, but that doesn't matter. The main thing is the touching it. Love renders atonement unavoidable. You see, we get now a subjective view of it. It's no more a sense, can I atone, will I atone, will I have strength to atone, will I be wakeful enough, and so on, and so on. Here is now that sublime standpoint which says, after all, behind atonement stands the divine fact. What is the divine fact of atonement? Is at one, to be at one. Is that unity, that unity which exists from time immemorial, that God and man is one, and because God and man is one, that love has a Christ, namely that love works so to establish that unity and re-establish that unity and reinforce that unity over and over and over again, and has that force which is able to work on a situation such that the human mind is giving up its resistance towards atonement and just cannot resist it. And so atonement is inevitable, unavoidable. Love is forcible. So all through that last subject, that's the overtone, which we may keep alive in our thoughts. That wonderful sense, comforting sense, that whatever my mistakes are, that whatever my failures are, that whatever my shortcomings are, that doesn't touch in the slightest that love of God towards her idea. The love of God towards love's idea, which says, I draw you to me. I draw as mind, I draw your mindedness to the divine mindedness. I draw you to heaven, to the heavenly state of mind. And so, in love as mind, as I have indicated here, we get the tone of love as design and final purpose, which has a reward in heaven. We'll see that love here is being depicted as that love which has an intention, a design. You see here the design is typically love as mind. It's love that plans, but it is mind because it has an intelligent intention, an intelligence working out. It's the design of love to reform the sinner. That's how she starts the subject. It's the design which has a final purpose. Love is always that which is telefinalistic. It has always a final purpose of fulfillment. What is that fulfillment? It gives as its reward heaven. That's the tone of love going through that first subject of love as mind. And then I gave you the touch of mind running through this subject. We have a lot to do about the law and the justice and the divine intention. Showing what? If we combine these two tones, you see, we come to the epitome which I have given here, that it is the law of love which inevitably confers a full reward on a heavenly state of mind. I may have put it in six other verse and in different verse. I may have just the same said, perhaps, that it is in the design of love to work such that it draws every mind towards the divine mind, or that it is the purpose of love, design of love, that it inevitably translates an egoistic, self-centered, worldly mind into a divine mindedness, into a heavenly mindedness. I like that. I like, because so often somebody will say, oh, I would like to have a divine mindedness, but I feel I can't do it, it's too heavy, or I'm not good enough, or I'm not inspired enough, and so on. From the standpoint of love, we can express that inward tenderness and motherhood which says, well, you are all wrong. That is not the question. The facts of being are that love is and that mind is. And that means that because love is always at one with love's idea. And love's idea here is mind, therefore, is always at one with a heavenly state of mind. And therefore always draws every state of mind towards a heavenly state of mind, no matter what the situation may be. How does she develop this thought, this epitome? How does she develop how love draws us to a heavenly state of mind? And what does she say that must be expelled from that state of love in order that that mind is willingly and happily and joyfully accepting a heavenly state of mind? So I gave you in few words the subtone, and you just can follow it how we go on, how this is depicted. She starts by showing that heaven really is a state of mind, that not a locality. But really heaven and hell are no localities. They are states of consciousness, states of mind, you see. But thank God she doesn't leave it at that. Most Christian scientists leave it at that. They say, well, it's a state of mind, and leave it at that. Well, that's only the touch of mind. Then she goes on to spirit and says, yes, but that heavenly state, heaven as a state of mind, can only be known by experiencing purity and affection, by experiencing, not just by thinking it, out, you see. Then she says, well, that mind must be so that it is a translation of the human mind into a pure mind, into a mind which knows purity and affection by experience. You see how this second chapter always has to do with experience, that it says experience brings understanding. Here she never says that just thinking brings understanding. It's usually experience, going through the life experience, that Jesus' disciples only began to understand Jesus after they have experienced Jesus' resurrection and so on. It's experience that brings here understanding, and it's a good thing to see that. So she says, that heavenly state of mind is not something that is just going on in mind, in thinking, but let's experience it through purity and affection. And then she can go on to the touch of soul and say that in this experience, the love of sin must be quenched by sufficient suffering. Says no sinful thought, you see, can ever enter into heaven. That every sinful thought, every sinful motion must be first quenched, and especially the love of sin must be quenched, and it must be quenched by sufficient suffering, not by insufficient suffering. It must be sufficient suffering, meaning that sin, that soul, doesn't let a single part of sin through the door. That it must be completely outbalanced, that sin must be completely outbalanced, sufficiently outbalanced. And the love of sin usually is only outbalanced by suffering. So he shows that we can't enter the heaven of soul if not every love of sin is being quenched. And because she says that, she goes on to principle and must give the interpretation of it and the reason of it and the explication of it. And her explication of it is that in God's government does not allow a mere pardon of sin. She says in there that truth does not pardon error, and that we cannot escape from punishment, and that we can that there is no remittance of penalty due for sin. You see, you get here the heavenly law of government and the heavenly law of pardon. which is against that sense that we can get into heaven by asking God, who is so good and so loving, that he remits the penalty, says it will come. The religious thought says, I like to go into heaven, into that heavenly state of mind, and in order to enter that, I pray and beg God that he atones with me, and therefore that he pardons error, or that he remits the penalty due for sin, or that I try to escape punishment. And she says, that all can't be done. Principle is completely impersonal and completely scientific, and therefore demands also the complete correction of sin, and no other escape. So you see the way into heaven. Then she says, all right, in life she says that spirituality, heavenly-mindedness, you see, spirituality, that knowing heaven through spiritual affection, that spirituality requires paying the earthly price. Here life always, when it comes to life, have you noticed that the moment it comes to such a of life, you always get that sense of paying the price, of sacrifice, of laying down the mortal. It's as exact like a Swiss watch. In that whole chapter, you see these tones just recur and recur exactly in the right place with the right tone, always in another hue and another shade. Here it is, well, justice must be the handmaid of mercy. And therefore justice demands that we pay the earthly price. And the earthly price, it says, is to be forsaken by the worldly minded, or finding no favor with the worldly minded. You see, if you want to be heavenly minded, if you want to have that heavenly state, we jolly well have to lay down that worldly mindedness. That's our sacrifice we have to give. And to lay down that sense that the worldly minded will help us, and that the worldly mindedness can help us to push us into heaven and so on. Says no, we have to pay the earthly price. And so, finally, in truth, in the third tone of truth, he says that the form of this earthly price, he depicts what is the form of this earthly price. And he says, well, the form of this earthly price is righteousness and well and right doing, true mindedness. That's our price we have to pay. To do right, to be right, to think right, to act right, that right doing, you see. That's the rightful retribution. It's the side note, right, righteous retribution for sin. It's doing right. That's the price we have to pay, to do right. And if we do right, we are right, and so we are in heaven. That's the heaven. Heaven is not another locality or another thing than just the fact that we do right. And so, lastly, she gives the sense that the reward of doing right is heaven, the redemption, therefore, from sin and suffering. Well, there is a lot in that subject. We could easily take an hour or 2 hours on this. There is a lot of deep insight in this subject. But I don't want to go into too many details so that I don't mar the big picture. You say mar the big picture, efface the big picture. So let's just see what Lover's Mind here really says. You see, if you recapitulate again in our work. We just see, you know, let's see what the first subject told us. Yesterday we recapitulated that, and saw that the first subject of mind showed us that mind urges us and spurs us on and commands us to atone, to atone ourselves with the divine mind, was the demand. But behind that demand of atoning our mind with the divine mind really lies here love. And here in love we get now the subjective view of that subject, where love says, well, it's love that demands it. And it isn't the human wish that demands it. It isn't the human earth that demands it. Behind it is the fact in reality, the divine fact existing in reality, which says mind is always atoned with mind. And therefore mind always draws all towards the divine mind. And here we see it, how she shows that love forces the sinner to reform. How love... Who is the sinner? The sinner is here always. You see, it's in here comes in the scriptural note. The sinner is always that which breaks the atonement. Sin is a breakage.